Okay, we're now recording. Today is October 7th, 2011. This is Scott Jedlicka at the University of Texas at Austin, at the H.J. Letcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports Institute for Olympic Studies. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I am interviewing Andreas Weigand over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. And am I saying that correctly, Weigand?
That's real close.
Okay.
I pronounce it German way, Weigand, but it's
Weigand. Okay.
You're probably closer than most people.
All right. I guess we'll start off with just some basic, biographical background information. Can you tell me a little bit about your childhood, where you grew up, where you were born, how you first got involved with sports?
Okay. I was born in Germany, came to the U.S. when I was three. My father was one of the rocket scientists in Germany during World War II and was more or less recruited from the U.S., the space program and so forth, and continued to work for the U.S. Air Force through his retirement in the 70s. And we moved around several places, Ohio, New Mexico, and ended up in Arlington, Virginia, where he worked in the Pentagon. And that's where I started my canoeing at the Washington Canoe Club in D.C. And
how old were you when you started that?
I think I was either 13 or 14 when a teacher from my junior high brought a bunch of kids down to the boat club. And we started in these Canadian, what they call Canadian war canoes, which held 15 people. Went up to Canada for a race that summer and so forth. Did pretty well. And after quite a few years, I was one of the few left out of about 50 kids.
And so you competed then throughout high school?
I did, yes. I mean, it wasn't directly associated with a school, but it was. I competed during the summer while I was in high school.
Okay.
And college.
Were you doing any other sports then, or?
I did some running. I was in cross country and track team in high school.
Those are my sports too. So, solidarity. I guess, did you have any major influences? I know you mentioned your junior high teacher first got you started, but were there any other major influences on your rowing?
Just some of the folks that I met once I got down to the canoe club. Frank Havens was an Olympian and a gold medal winner, I think, in 52. And he was sort of a mentor there for a while. And anyway, I guess that would be the biggest influence, keep me going and so forth. So,
all right, would you mind spelling that just so I can get it down?
Frank Havens is H-A-V-E-N-S, H Hotel.
Okay, I got it. All right. I guess moving on then, did you continue to canoe in college as part of a team or?
Again, not as part of a team.
Okay.
It was all associated with the boat club. The colleges didn't really have canoeing teams. I went one year to Penn State where I couldn't do much except when I got home in the summer, and then I transferred to American University, which was there in Washington, so I was able to work out the same time I was going to school.
Okay, and did you go to American? Or?
Yes,
oh, okay.
I graduated there.
All right. And what year was that?
68.
Oh, okay, so that's a great lead-in to my next sort of area of questioning, which is sort of the lead-up to the 68 Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
So what sort of training were you doing leading up to Mexico City?
It was, most of it was on my own and then some groups of other canoeists and so forth, but we didn't have really organized coaching as such. I'd done enough of conditioning with my running and so forth. I knew more or less what I was trying to do, at least, but still it wasn't so much support other than from the boat club, and that was just the facilities more or less, and the
So,
place to work out.
So were you working then as well to support yourself?
Well, during school, I was working part-time and going to school full-time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, working out
okay.
as best I could. And also, during that time, we did some indoor training at, one of the naval testing, boat testing facilities in Maryland. They have a, they let us use the facility as indoor, about a 900 meter long water tank that they put boats along and so forth, model basin where they tested model boats.
Oh.
You know, and they had these tracks and so forth, and it was pretty elaborate, and every once in a while we went out and worked out there in the winter when it was really miserable.
Did you have any, were you, like, married at this time? Did you have children, or were you still single, or?
I was married, and I guess separated, and I had a daughter who was born in 66.
Okay. Did your training sort of affect your relationship with those people, or?
Probably. You know, after I graduated, I went out to California where the Olympic trials were going to be held and worked out there for the rest of the summer.
And what was that like?
it was pretty stark. We had a house which is that we kept the boats at, but we couldn't really stay at the house. It was in Newport Beach, a nice place, you know, very expensive even in those days. So we had a facility to work out with, but mostly I was living in my van and using that facility for cleaning up in the boat club and so forth out of the garage. Which was nice that they lent the facility and the docks. But still, it was, you know, not the best of living conditions.
Did you have a lot of friends there at the training center?
My brother was there. We had about five of us working out there together.
Okay. And so then the trials came up then that summer?
Long Beach. The trials for us were in Long Beach in, I think it was around Labor Day.
Okay, and like
the late Olympics in 68, as you probably know, October. So I think it was the weekend of Labor Day that we had our trials.
And how did that whole process work with the qualifying?
It was at the in Long Beach where they held the 32 Olympic rowing and canoeing course. How much detail do you want to know about the trials themselves?
Maybe just sort of the general qualifying system. I mean, you don't have to get into
it. You know, every time I raced in these Olympic trials, they had a different method.
Oh, really?
Every time they weeded it down to one group of final boats. In other words, there was in canoeing, there's nine lanes. So they had the heats and so forth, so it got down to nine in the finals of each event.
Mm-hmm.
And then for that event, they had three races, and they were going to take the top point scores from those three races. And they were only about an hour and a half apart.
Oh, wow.
So for the single, I raced all my single races one afternoon. Three of them, and then the next day I had the double races.
Okay, and
again.
And then, so which events did you then qualify for 68?
Actually, I won all of them. I won all three of the single races, and I won all three of the doubles.
Wow.
But I ended up in Mexico only racing the single.
Okay, and why was that?
Coach's decision, more or less, I guess.
So throughout this whole, you know, trials process, what sort of, like, hometown support did you have, if any?
Hometown, nothing. Just the group that we were together with.
Okay.
That we were training in Newport. Newport Beach, I should say. There's other Newports around.
Okay. I guess while we're on the subject of leading up to Mexico City, one of the big factors that's a little unique to these Olympics is the altitude of Mexico City. Can you describe how you prepared for that?
After the trials, the canoeing team went to Tahoe for about 2 weeks, which it was just a little over 6,000 foot elevation, and we worked out there. And then we were one of the early teams to go down to Mexico City, so the entire, I think we were there close to 6 weeks, not, and our races were at the end of the Olympics, so I had almost 5 weeks at Mexico City at high altitude. And it definitely, you could tell the difference even from Tahoe to Mexico. You know, the extra 1,000 feet was noticeable. It when I first started working out there in Mexico, it felt like I was out of shape. And the only thing I could tell was my recovery was much better than if I'd just really been out of shape.
Yeah.
You know, so the recovery time was good still, but it just felt terrible. But after 2 weeks or so, it helped a lot.
Good. Anything else you remember about the lead up to the games or preparations or anything like that?
Just the fact that we were one of the early teams. The canoeing team was one of the early teams to go down there, and we traveled down there with a diving team. So we made some good friends with the U.S. diving team, who were also down there for an extended period. Some teams just came in right before, and so forth. So it was fun getting to know another smaller team. And
so I guess each sport traveled individually then?
Yeah, everybody, they always have a gathering spot in the U.S. before, you know, where you get processed with IDs and uniforms and things like that, and that was in Denver. So we met the diving team there in Denver, and both of those teams went down to Mexico at the same time.
Is there anyone in particular that you remember off the diving team?
I'm sorry?
Is there anyone in particular that you can remember off the diving team that you were close to?
Well, it was Mickey King, who the girl diver, and Kiala from Hawaii, Kiala O'Sullivan. She ended up with a bronze medal, and we were good friends while we were down in Mexico.
Okay.
And those two in particular, I'd say.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, just to wrap up the preparation part, anything else you'd like to add?
No, not really. We were in Tahoe during the time that the track team had their trials in South Tahoe, and I was able to travel down there and watch a little bit of that, which was also relatively informal in a small area there where they were training, you know, at high altitude, and that was a lot of fun because we'd already been on, you know, we were already on the team, so we got to go in there and watch, and there wasn't a lot of spectators there. It wasn't a big event, but it was certainly important to them.
Yeah, and I'm sure it was relaxing to already have your qualifying out of the way.
Right. So that was fun. I think we did that twice in a couple of the events, which is impressive.
Yeah. Before we move on, I just want to remind you, this was in the information, but you will have an opportunity after this is transcribed to look it over before it's made available, so you can make an addendum or anything.
Okay.
If you forgot anything, so just keep that in mind as we're going forward.
Are you going to do that by email?
Yeah, I mean, it may take...
That's probably the easiest, right?
Yeah, I mean, it may take, you know, several months to a year before the transcription is done, but you will definitely get a copy at some point.
Well, what I've remembered 40 years, so it shouldn't go away in the next couple of months.
Okay. I guess moving on then, my next sort of subject on my list here is the Olympic Project for Human Rights and the Harvard Crew Letter. Do you remember anything about this, hearing about possible protests or boycotts by members of the U.S. team?
You mean the Black Power and those things? You know, at the time, when I was working out after I got out of college, I was a little bit of a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't really on top of a lot of those things. So until I got to Mexico and started becoming aware of those, I didn't know much about it. And as I was down there, I tried to go to some of the practices and even some of the events. And one of the ones I really liked was track and field, so I was, you know, was staying on top of that, and I definitely saw what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that, but I didn't really know much about it until I got to Mexico. That and the Czech and the USSR issues.
Mm-hmm.
was the other big event internationally, I guess, at the time. What I had been told when I got down there was that the Czech and the Russian, Soviet teams were supposed to be housed in the same quarters, same building, until all this turmoil started, and then they decided to separate them, which probably made a lot of sense. But, I only learned about those things when I was down there just because I think I was living in more or less a vacuum during that summer. And
yeah.
And through the Olympic trials and so forth, kind of self-absorbed in my training.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember or were aware of the student protests in Mexico City before the games. I mean, did you...
I didn't know about it before, or very little of it. I think I heard about it when we were traveling down there, like in Denver and so forth, and that there was going to be some issues. It didn't ever seem to be a problem. I know they had a lot of army military people around to avoid issues, for the marathon and the and the long distance events, the race walkers. And they had people standing almost at arm length the whole time, the whole course, you know, even up to the 50 kilometer walk.
Oh yeah.
They had the army folks there, so there was a lot of that present. But
so it'd be safe to say that the games were pretty secure in your eyes.
Yes and no. they certainly looked like they were secure. I don't think there was any real issues that came up. On the other hand, I know a lot of people have snuck into Olympic villages and so forth, and you know, just with having a sweat jacket on and. They snuck in friends and other things like that. So that type of security wasn't nearly as tight as it was, you know, 4 or 8 years later.
Right.
But that was before a lot of the terrorism really hit, too. So
right.
They weren't, you didn't have metal detectors or anything like that. So it appeared to be secure, but you could get by a lot of the things.
Mm. Okay. So, just the city in general, what were your impressions? Did you have any interactions with people living there? Or
We did have a lot of time there, and a few evenings we went into town just to look around and so forth, and we walk out of the village, and cars would come screeching to a halt to give us rides to anywhere we wanted to go. And the other way around in town, you just, you know, there were actually more than one car stopping before you even trying to get a ride with anybody. So it was amazing in that respect. And we got to know a few of the locals that way and went into some of the, you know, places. So we got to see the inner city that way a little bit. So it was fun.
Did you need a translator or did you use one or need one? Or?
Most people, no.
No?
I didn't know enough Spanish to get by, but most people knew enough few English words where we could communicate. But it was, the people were very nice.
Did you ever take them up on their offers for rides?
Oh, yeah, sure.
What did you think of the event venues themselves and the facilities? I know that you competed in several games, so maybe... Comparatively speaking, you know, how are the facilities?
This was my first international race, other than some trips I've gone into Canada, Toronto, and so forth. But the first international with the Europeans, so everything was new to me. the people and the venue was great as far as I was concerned. I mean, they dug a canal out of the swamps there in Xochimilco, and the course was perfect. It was just amazing that it was a few thousand people showing up for workouts, which was pretty incredible. I think they let them in free, but still, it was still amazing that people would just come out there to see the workouts and things. So,
wow.
And they had, here's an aside. I would try to go, you know, I was working out twice a day, but I in between I'd have a few hours here and there, and I'd try to go see some other workouts or events. And they had buses to go from the village to each of the venues, and they were brand new Ford buses. And there was times I was the only one on the bus, you know, going to, like, I'd go to the swimming workout or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't when all the swimming teams were going there, but it was when I was available. And I was on this brand new bus all by myself, and next to us were these old beat up buses with people hanging out because it was just so full. I was thinking, wow, this is kind of obscene almost.
Mm-hmm.
the differences in the two systems.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was quite a contrast. But, you know, as far as facilities go, they were great.
Okay.
I have no complaints at all.
I guess, does that extend to the dorms and where you were staying in the village?
Right. Everything was brand new. They turned them into apartments afterwards, but they were brand new. And the men's canoeing team was in an apartment, like a two or three bedroom apartment. But, you know, each of the rooms was made up to be a bedroom and so forth. So quite a few of us stayed in one apartment. And everybody had, you know, single beds and so forth. I think I was in a small little, almost a large closet, and I was by myself. And they had these single beds, and I'm a little over 6 foot, but not, you know, I was like 6'2" or something. And they had these single beds, which are fairly narrow and 6 foot long with the metal edges. And I asked one of the workers there, is there any way to get a little bit bigger bed? And so the next day they brought in a bed. Again, it was a single bed, but it was 7.5 feet long. I guess it was for the basketball players or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But there's quite a difference. I didn't need one quite that big, but that was the choices.
So, I guess, you know, rooming situations. Do you remember who was in your apartment or who you roomed with?
The entire men's canoeing team.
Okay.
You know, canoeing, kayaking. The canoeing includes the kayaking
mm-hmm.
folks and so forth. So there was about eight. How many were there? Four, six. I think there was 10 of us.
Okay. Do you remember, like, what the food was like? I know that's sort of the common thing is don't drink the water in Mexico, but, I mean, what was...
When we were in Denver, they gave us shots against issues with water and so forth, and
mm-hmm.
I don't know how effective they were, but very few of us had any problems. All the water in the village was bottled water,
okay.
So there wasn't any problems. And,
okay.
And I think they were very, very careful. I mean, if I was going down to Mexico now, you know, the fresh vegetables and things like that is what you have to worry about,
mm-hmm.
unless you're in one of the bigger hotels.
Right.
But everything there at the village was, I forgot what the catering service was, but I think it was either came from the U.S. or a European catering service.
Oh, okay.
They certainly washed all the vegetables and so forth with the clean water, and I don't think very many people had problems at all.
That's good.
And most of those were probably from town.
Ah.
So I had the food was fine. It was a little bit bland, but you know, they had cafeterias open basically around the clock, where they had, you know, they had the bigger meals, but then they'd have snacks and so forth going into the night because people did have events that were late, and you know, so so mm-hmm. you could eat anytime you wanted to.
Well, you mentioned earlier about people, sneaking in and out of the village.
Which,
I mean, was that locals or who? Can you talk
mostly,
about?
Team members, relatives.
Ah.
That type of thing. A team member would bring a sweatshirt out and bring his wife in or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't any ill intent, although, it wouldn't have passed security.
Yeah.
Tight security, put it that way. So, but that was fairly commonplace.
Okay. Do you, moving to the games themselves, and, they always start with the opening ceremony. What do you remember about the opening ceremony? Did you march out, and where were you, and things like that?
The opening ceremony, the stadium was fairly close to the village. And if I remember right, we walked up there and had a gathering area for all the teams. And then they'd call in one team at a time. It was exciting, especially going into the stadium you're standing outside with all the teams to start with, and then gradually going in there and seeing all the crowds and the rest of the teams lined up, and it was pretty impressive. It was like I said, it was my first international event of any kind, and having it being the Olympics was extra special. I know a few, I'll give you another aside, a few days before opening ceremony, I guess the normal procedure was that the teams marched in line, in step, and so forth. So the USOC had a person that was I don't know if he was still in the military or whatever, but he was going to teach us how to march in, mm-hmm. stay in line and all this stuff. He was a former colonel,
mm-hmm.
Army colonel, and we had two practices, and that was a complete disaster. It wasn't the time to try to teach these people to march in, so they finally gave up. And I think that was the first Olympics where people walked as they wished. We still stayed in the group, but we certainly didn't march as an army unit. At least the U.S. team did not. And then it progressively got more lax,
mm-hmm.
Through the other Olympics, I think, from there. But I think that was the first time they didn't march in unison, put it that way. So I don't know if you got any films of that, but
I don't know.
There was about two attempts at us to learn how to march, and it was they gave up.
Yeah. Did you march in then with the canoeing team, or were you sort of mixed in with others?
It was I don't know exactly. I can't remember. There was a few of the canoeing people next to us, but it wasn't organized that way. The few, obviously the person carrying the flag was designated, and I think a few of the people they had in the front for the cameras were assigned. But other than that, people more or less lined up as they wanted.
Okay. So I guess the next thing I would like to hear about is your event, and sort of take us through your actual competition, what you did in the days leading up, how it went, what you were feeling, things like that.
Yeah. Well, it was heats and repechage, what they call it, that you go to if you don't make it qualified to the semifinals. So I went through my heats, and I qualified for a semifinal. And each of these is a different day.
I
think I was third in my heat. I don't remember exactly, but the semifinal was a good day, and they had three semifinals, and the top three boats were going to go to the finals. So there was going to be nine boats in the finals, and I was feeling really good in the semifinal. And halfway through, I was trying to relax. I was in second place, so I was doing well. And the one thing I remember is I was relaxing a little bit too much, and I hit the water with my paddle on the return, and my hand actually came off the thing, and I almost dropped my paddle, and my race was almost over right there. You know, without a paddle, I wasn't going to go too far. I might have even fallen out of the boat or something, but I finally grabbed it all, scrambled back in, and ended up finishing second there in a semi and qualifying for the final. The final was somewhat overwhelming. I had a strong headwind, and I don't know why. Throughout my career, I never did well in the headwind, and I didn't have my best race. And not only that, one of the favorite folks were right next to me, a Hungarian. Actually, he was in the guy that ended up winning. But on the start, I got ahead of him, which was a little bit disconcerting because I was kind of going to try to pace myself with him. But then about a third of the way through, he had a huge surge, and he went by me so fast I was, again, a little overwhelmed and got a little bit of the wash and so forth. So I ended up in eighth place, which wasn't nearly as well as I had hoped to do. But I didn't have my best race, but considering, you know, that was my first international competition and so forth, I was hoping to do better in the future.
Right. And which distance was this?
It was the only distance they had at the time. It was 1,000 meters, which is, okay, you know, 4 minutes plus race.
Okay. And then I know you said you qualified in other individual races.
That's the only race I had.
Oh, okay.
I only raced in a single.
Okay. All right.
But I qualified in the double, two-man.
Right. Okay.
But they ended up racing another team.
Did you? I know you said you got pretty acclimated to the altitude. Did you notice that during the competition at all?
No, I think I was acclimated about as much. My times there were, you know, on the good conditions were as good as I had been. So I wasn't. I don't think I was affected at that point, but I'd been there. You know, our races were the last few days of the competition, so it was end of October. So I'd been there close to 6 weeks.
And could you say again where it was held or what the site was called?
I don't think I can spell it, but it starts with an X, and it was pronounced Solchamico.
Okay.
X Solchamico Milko. I'd have to look it up on the internet.
That's fine.
It was about 5 or 6 miles from the Olympic Village.
Okay.
Wasn't bad. Down a freeway, we went past the soccer stadium and so forth. They had buses that went back and forth on a regular basis, and it was fine. They had the rowing the first week of the competition on the same course, which makes sense because the rowers take up more room and so forth, and they had a little side canal that we had to work out on while the rowing races were actually taking place, but we could still work out. It wasn't a big problem. And then the rowers were finished, and then the canoeing event started.
Do you remember what you did right afterwards, after your race was over?
Right after the race was over?
Yeah.
I know that evening I went to see the boxing finals, and I saw George Foreman, which was just a big deal for me.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the last events, the boxing, and so I enjoyed that. I tried to see a few events here and there, and I went to the track stadium, which was real close to the village. Evenings, sometimes I spent an hour over there, and they had they had a section for the athletes where you go and sit, and it was just right there at the finish line. It was beautiful. You go and stay there as long as you want and leave. And of course, you know, I had other things to do, like work out and so forth, but in the evenings I usually get an hour or so in there, try to see some of the track events. A lot of fun.
Now, I know you mentioned a couple of the women divers who you were close with. Did you make friends with anyone else outside the canoeing team while you were down there?
Not close. I mean, maybe talking and so forth, but not on a close basis, because we were, you know, we were doing our thing.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the rowers, we were on the bus with the rowers. I knew some of the rowers. U.S. And I spoke with some of the German folks. I was German initially, and I still knew some German,
mm-hmm.
even though I felt like I was an American. I could converse with those and got to know a few of the German paddlers and rowers.
Yeah, I guess these were the first time that an East German team competed as a separate Olympic team. Do you when you say you talked to the Germans, were they
mostly East? West Germans?
West, okay.
Yeah, the East Germans were a little standoffish.
Yeah. Talk more about that. I know East Germans and, I guess, the Soviet athletes, were they both sort of... did you have any interaction with them, or...?
You know, they have... Or they had what they call political officers, and they had these people kind of standing off in the background, making sure there wasn't too much interaction going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the athletes were very aware of that and very shy of conversing too much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, through my later years and some of my international races and other places and so forth, I got to know and talk to some of them a little bit closer, but during the 68 Olympics, I didn't really interact very much with them, just because it was frowned upon,
right.
from their end.
Mm. Okay, so the 68 games were also the first time that gender verification was done, and also the first time that doping control really got ramped up. Do you have any thoughts or feelings about those, or were you subjected to any drug tests, or?
We had doping controls, but nothing resembling steroid tests.
Right.
I know all the Eastern Bloc countries. I mean, it was, especially knowing what I know now,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't unheard of. In fact, it was probably fairly prevalent in some of the teams, and the U.S. teams too, some of the sports. But I'd say the Eastern Bloc countries, it'd be rare to find an East German that wasn't taking steroids. And I don't really blame them. You know, they were given whatever they were given, and here's your pills, and you take them,
mm-hmm.
or you're not going to be competing, type of thing. So it's not something that they consciously decided that they're going to do.
Right.
On the other hand, it was tough to compete against.
Yeah, I imagine so. So did you know anyone personally that got tested or anything?
Nobody got tested for steroids.
Right.
A lot of people got all the first three qualifiers in each of the heats, so forth, were tested the drug test,
mm-hmm.
the urine test for uppers, type of thing,
mm-hmm.
some those types of drugs.
Amphetamines and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Were you aware that there was a Swedish pentathlete that got disqualified in Mexico City for drug use? And did you hear about that? Were there any rumors sort of circulating, or?
No, I didn't. I don't think I remember that. I know the one runner, I think that was who won the two events, the two long distance runner, there was a lot of rumors about the blood doping. Of course, mm-hmm. they couldn't test that either. But that was kind of the first time that they were talking about that quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was either Swedish or Norwegian. I can't remember. He won double gold medal winner in two straight Olympics.
Yeah, Viren?
Yeah.
From Finland? Yeah.
There was a lot of talk about that there and afterwards.
I know we talked about it a little bit earlier, but...
You know what I mean by blood doping, right?
Right, yeah, yep.
Yeah, they couldn't test for that.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, it's still difficult, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It is. I know we talked about this earlier, but let's revisit the Black Power salute with Tommy Smith and John Carlos, because that was sort of one of the most visible events of these games and what they're sort of most remembered for in some respects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you have any memories? Were you there when it happened?
I didn't see the their events. They had the Black Power thing marching in.
Yeah.
A few of the track people in particular, I think. Obviously, those two and others were raising their fists and so forth, marching in on the opening ceremonies. And I had no negative feelings on that. I felt like I'm glad they competed. For a while, it looked like they were going to not compete and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know after the awards ceremonies, it was said that the two of them were ushered out and banned,
right,
and sent off the Olympic team. Now, I'd be 98% sure I saw them in the Olympic Village 2 days later. So I don't think they were sent home right away. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can verify that with other people, a lot closer to them. But, I know they didn't compete again. But I don't think they were scheduled to compete again. But I was actually sorry to hear all the negative publicity when it happened, or after it happened. I was somewhat of a sympathizer,
mm-hmm,
kind of detached to the whole, stuff, because I didn't just know enough about it, and I wasn't part of the track team, and
mm-hmm,
so on.
So I know you said that in the lead up to the games, you were sort of insulated in your training and stuff. Did your views toward those two and toward what they were sort of demonstrating for, did those feelings sort of develop while you were down there, or had you sort of held those?
Yeah, and I was sympathetic to some extent, although I didn't know enough about it to really give a great political opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, I was glad they competed. I wasn't upset by the fact that they were doing the salute and so forth during the ceremonies, the middle ceremonies, and
mm-hmm,
you didn't hear so much negative until we got back home, and then that's where we heard all the negative publicity.
Mm-hmm. So I guess what were the other athletes saying? Were they sort of
mostly supportive, I think.
Really?
Yeah, nobody was, trying to ostracize them that I could see. But again, I wasn't living there in that building even.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess it was the same building. I think all the U.S. was in the same, but we were a separate floor, and you just saw them here and there, but not on a regular basis. I mean, we went our separate ways, and workout schedules were different, and
mm-hmm,
those types of things, so... But, yeah, I didn't hear any real negative comments or anything else from anybody,
okay,
in the village.
I guess, you said there was a lot of negative media publicity surrounding that. Can you talk just about the media more generally, maybe, in Mexico City? What sort of coverage?
There wasn't much in the village. I think they were pretty limited.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody was really overwhelmed by news people in the village. The first time I even got any news folks surrounding, us, and it was at the opening ceremonies. They were kind of wandering through the staging area before we walked into the stadium, and there was folks there, asking opinions and
mm-hmm,
so forth. But not so much. I was never asked anything about Black Power,
okay,
those kind of things. Of course, I wasn't part of the track team, and I wasn't black, to start with, so I guess I wasn't one of the ones that they would naturally ask.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any specific memories of, like, record-setting events or big, you know, athletic feats that happened at these games? Or did you see any personal?
The Beeman jump was just incredible. I saw that.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was an event. I remember, I think it was John Powell, pole vaulter. He got, he would have got a silver medal, but his pole went underneath the crossbar, which was outlawed at that point, and every event after that, it's now legal. It doesn't matter where the pole goes.
Right.
But at that point, the pole had to go back, fall backwards. And so his jump didn't count, and I think that would have given him a silver medal. And I remember talking to him briefly afterwards in the elevator, and he was very upset about the whole deal.
Yeah,
and rightly so. But
And he was an American?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I think his name was John Powell. I don't know where he ended up. He was a good pole vaulter, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if he got a medal or not. He didn't get silver. He probably ended up about fourth or fifth, if I remember right.
And so you said you were in the stadium for Beeman's jump. What was that like?
Well, that was incredible. I mean, it came out of nowhere. It seemed to have come out of nowhere. I was on the other side. It was, you know, other events were going on, but and then everybody was just amazed. And of course, you know, you saw the films of him.
Right.
Kind of being overwhelmed and basically not even being able to jump again. I mean, he kind of went through the motions, but he couldn't gather his thoughts together to even compete, you know, to make a decent jump again. But everybody was, the whole stadium kind of hushed, fell in a hush, and was when they flashed up the distance. Yeah. That was an event. That was the one I remember the most.
Any other, I mean, not maybe just sports specific, but any other memorable stories, interesting events? I mean, what was the most memorable part for you competing at the games?
I think my most memorable one was the closing ceremonies. That was the most emotional part. It was even nicer than the opening ceremonies. It was a relaxed atmosphere. Everybody was very, you know, upbeat and very informal. I'd say that was probably the best time of the whole games.
So, I mean, can you just describe that maybe in a little more detail? I mean, everyone always watches the opening ceremonies, but I don't feel like...
It was the evening, and I try not to mix up a couple of the closing ceremonies together here. I don't remember since I went to more than one. But it was just, you know, the intermingling of the different teams... was much more evident. We didn't go in as a team as such, and I think they actually tried to keep everybody from going in, but everybody that was there, you know, some of the teams already went home early and so forth. And by teams, I meant sports, and also a lot of the international teams. You know, they would be there as long as their event was there, and then they'd send them home. For cost and other reasons, security, you know, the Eastern Bloc countries, they didn't like to keep the guys there after his events. But most of the U.S. people were still there, unless they had a reason to go home. So the teams were much more mixed together, and everybody was more joyous, and, you know, there wasn't the tension.
Right.
I mean, the opening ceremony, some of the folks had an event the next morning, so it was I'm not sure I would have gone to opening ceremonies if I'd had a race the next morning. If I know some of the rowers did do that, and they you know, a few skipped opening ceremonies just because it's hours of standing around and then trying to compete the next day is not the best combination. But the closing ceremony, all that was over, good or bad, and everybody was very relaxed and joyous mood, and in the evening, it just the whole atmosphere was great. And the stands, you know, and people were, some of the athletes were actually going into the stands and intermixing with the fans and so forth. And you know, the security, again, was not what it would be now.
Right.
Or after the Munich Olympics.
Mm-hmm. Tom Lowe, who sort of got this project going, he said that your brother Peter also competed at these games. Would you mind, you know, sharing maybe some of his experiences or how you interacted with him or anything like that, if you're comfortable doing that?
Yeah, I can't give you very many details. Obviously, he was there the same period that I was there. He raced in a two-man kayak. They didn't make the finals. I think the coaches didn't do a very good job of grouping the teams. He won the two-man kayak in the trials, and then they split up the team, the two of them, and I think ended up a much slower boat than they had, which actually was the case for me too. I think I could have done much better in the two-man than the team that raced. But that, you know, I don't want to make it sound like sour grapes there. So. But for him, I think it was particularly bad where they split up the boat and ended up, they hadn't trained together very long, and they didn't make the finals and didn't do very well. So it was disappointing in that respect for him. He was a frustrated musician through his high school and days and so forth, and he was a cellist and very good at it, and he'd gotten some offers and so forth to go into some orchestras, and I remember one instance when he was at the Olympic Village, where there was a lady in the village that had a cello and was playing kind of off to the side. I don't think she was an athlete, but I think somehow she was attached, and he went over there and talked to her and for quite a while and got to know her fairly well, and you know, saw her a few times, and anyway, so that was a shared you know, interest.
Yeah, right.
So that was nice. I can't give you personal details so much because I just don't remember that much about.
That's fine.
Things. I mean, we went to places together, obviously, even sharing some of the, you know, hitchhiking into town for an afternoon or whatever, once or twice. And
no, that's great.
Those types of things.
So, yes, you, where did you go after Mexico City? Did you go back to training or work? Or?
Well, I just graduated from college. And I went back to Newport Beach, and I was basically unemployed, and I was trying to find work, and I think kind of doing, well, I ended up working at a grocery store for a while, and then I finally got more of a career-type job in the aerospace industry. I got a degree in physics, and I got a job at what was called Philco Ford. Philco with a PH, you know, like Philco Ford was a division of Ford Motor that it was actually a weapons type facility that they tested some things and so forth there in Newport Beach. So I got a job there, and I worked there for 3 years until I quit for the next Olympics.
Did you have any sort of reception coming home from 68? I mean, was there any sort of celebratory things going on, like in your hometown?
Yeah, I was kind of a, I don't know, orphan in a way. I mean, I'd grown up from junior high through college in the D.C. area. I was living in Arlington, Virginia, and I worked out there all the way up until I graduated from college, and I went to Newport Beach, and I ended up staying in Newport Beach. So I didn't really have any roots there, but that's where I ended up going. So there really wasn't much of a gathering other than friends of mine and so forth that I had there. So then, no, it wasn't like I was from a small hometown and everybody was greeting me coming home.
Yeah.
I think if I'd gone back to D.C., the canoe club and the surrounding place, it would have had a little bit more of a gathering.
And so you said, you know, just reading about you, I know you competed in 72 and then again in 76. Were you training pretty consistently through those years, or did you sort of take chunks off, or how did that work?
72 was, I guess, my big shot to try to do as well as I could. And I don't remember ever not working out 2 days in a row.
Wow.
So I think the most I ever missed was 1 day workouts. I usually took 1 day a week off, but that was straight through the 72 Olympics. I worked at Philco Ford, and I lived close to the water there in Newport Beach, and everything was very close. And I worked out my schedule where I could take off in the winter. I took off a couple hours in the middle of the day, and I'd go home and work out in the water and then just work late and then do weights and so forth in the evenings. And then in the summertime when I was working out twice a day on the water, I would just work out early and then again after work. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, it was a compromise. I mean, I had to make a living, and a lot of the people I was competing against didn't. So,
are you talking about in America or
countries? I'd say mostly the Europeans, Eastern Europeans in particular. You know, that was their full-time profession.
Right. I guess, yeah, maybe...
Whatever they called it.
Yeah. Yeah, whatever they were, soldiers or police officers. Yeah. But I guess talk a little bit more about that, about, you know, the amateur rules and... You know, how all that's changed, and I mean, what did you think about all that? You know, did you see yourself as an amateur and that amateur ideal, or, you know?
I felt the amateur-professional distinction. I mean, I felt like the money that people may or may not be making off of, you know, what they're doing now, I guess the track folks are certainly making a living. Some of the other sports, maybe not. But, you know, that part, the making money, didn't bother me at all. The only thing that affected me was the time, the fact that they had all the time they needed to work out, and that was hard to compete against. But, you know, I worked it out, too. I mean, I worked around my job. They were fairly flexible. I took off... I know the first year I worked there, I took off about 6 weeks in the summer to go race, and I had a leave of absence. I wasn't getting paid, but they gave me a leave of absence, and they gave me the job back. And then the next year I took off even longer. I went to Europe and so forth. And then the last year, in 72, I quit in January to devote even more time. And they said, "Don't you want a leave of absence?" And I said, "No. I'm going to do something else." I, in the meantime, I'd been getting my teaching credential at Long Beach State, so I was going to go back and try to teach after I got out of the 72 Olympics. But so the amateur, the money part didn't bother me at all. The time involved, you know, the time that I had to spend working versus other people, and the support that they had with trainers and those types of things would have been nice.
When amateurism has sort of gone by the wayside today, do you think...
Right.
I mean, do you have any opinions on, you know, how that's affected the Olympics, or... that's sort of a broad question, but...
you know, the two people, or the two groups, I should say, they're probably making the most money and competing... That I know of are the basketball players, of course, mm-hmm. and the hockey players. And the difference of those two, in my view, is I think the hockey players, I feel like winning Olympics is still the biggest deal going for them. And the part I don't like about the basketball players is I think they'd rather win a NBA championship than they win the Olympics. It's mm-hmm. kind of an afterthought
yeah.
of the Olympics, and that's the part I don't like. You know, if it was the biggest event in their lives and so forth, I'd be all for them competing.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that they don't think that much about it, or don't, and they'll compete if it fits into their program.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think most of the guys are fairly devoted, especially this last time. I was pretty impressed from what I saw and heard of the Beijing team, the Olympic team, the basketball team. So that's the part that bothers me.
Yeah.
I'd like the Olympics to be the major event in any athlete's, you know, sports life.
Okay. Well, I just have some sort of broad, sort of reflective wrap-up questions here, so we're getting near the end.
Okay.
First off, I guess, you know, do you still participate in sport, in your sport that you did in the Olympics, or any other sorts of...
You know, it's funny you should ask that. I haven't been. And I had a... One of the big reasons is I had a big shoulder problem that's been bothering me for, you know, over 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's why I think I ended up not doing so well towards the end of my career. But it just kept nagging me, and any time I paddled hard and so forth. So that was a problem. But 6 weeks ago, I ended up joining this team. Very informal team. It's a dragon boat.
Oh yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm vaguely familiar.
Yeah. Well, they're popular. They're becoming more popular in the U.S. even, but they're very popular in Asia, Hong Kong, China, and in the Southeast Asia. And they're huge canoes that hold up to 20 people. They're really made for small people.
Mm.
You know, that get a real high stroke rate and so forth. But they have very informal practices in a team down here in Berkeley, and I've been going down there for the past, I'd say, 6 weeks, and it's fun. And so far my shoulder's holding up, so I'm optimistic.
That's good.
And it's helping me get a little bit better shape too, so it's all good. And it's fun to be with the paddlers. I haven't raced yet, just because it hasn't worked out with my schedule.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of fun, and you know, it's much more low key than anything I was involved in before.
Yeah, I'm sure. So, just looking back on your career, sort of a two-parter here. Who or what was your biggest influence, and then what sort of impact do you think canoeing at the top level had on your life?
I'd say that Frank Havens, again, was, as far as my canoeing was concerned, he kind of mentored me and got me going and so forth. And the first time, you know, I beat him in a race was a big event. Of course, I mean, he was much older and so forth, so it was a natural progression, of course, but still, it was a big deal. And I think he was the single most influential person. Then, through the years, and it wasn't during the 68 Olympics, but all three Olympics that I was in after that, I paddled with a fellow from Ohio that's one of my closest friends, and I still, you know, stay in touch with him. But again, he was not on the 68 team. Mm-hmm. Well, but I met him. He was at the 68 trials, and I met him there, and we became friends, and that's how we teamed up for later.
What was his name?
Roland Mullen, M-U-H-L-E-N.
Okay.
Roland.
Yeah.
His first name.
Got it. Thanks.
And I've kept friends from my paddling days. I mean, they're kind of scattered all over the country, but I still stay in touch with a few, and probably those are some of my closest friends. In fact, I was able to travel internationally. It was huge, and I think it helped me with my self-confidence and other things. You know, just as you get better in a sport, even kind of an unknown sport like canoeing, you realize, you build up your self-confidence and so forth. All that is really good.
Yeah.
And certainly the international flavor helps a lot. I did a lot of traveling all parts of Europe and even to the communist countries and so forth.
Mm.
That was very nice.
You sort of got at this when you were talking about the basketball team earlier, but what would be one piece of advice you would give to an athlete trying to get to the Olympics today?
I think the people that do well are the ones that are self-motivated. You know, just the consistency of working out. You can't expect something to happen overnight, but if you're willing to be consistent in your training, to just have personal goals and to kind of notch those up one at a time, and then make the Olympics your main goal. So in other words, not only are you trying to make the Olympic team, but your whole training career or workout career is peaking towards that. And I see that in people, track folks and so forth too. They just, they can't stay at the level they're at for the Olympic year, the 3 years in between.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's still emotionally, they have to let off and then build back up. And I think that's critical. I think I always did much better in races. And even though I felt like I was self-motivated and worked out hard and so forth, I wanted to make sure that the actual competition was still different than the workouts.
Mm-hmm.
Mentally, and then not only that, but the bigger races, the Olympic trials and the Olympics were even, the peak. And,
right.
And I tried to peak myself mentally as well as physically for those. But the consistency throughout the years in between is also important, and probably the most important thing.
Okay. Just final thoughts on the 68 games. I mean, we talked about a lot of the sort of big events, from the Black Power salute to drug testing to the Eastern Bloc and, the Cold War tensions there. What do you think was, like, the lasting impact of the 68 games? And then, I guess, since you did compete in others, how did they compare to Munich and Montreal?
Well, in general, overview, I think the Black Power thing did have quite an impact on the whole civil rights issue. Once the press and everybody else settled down, I mean, first it was a big black cloud hanging over it, but, a year or two later, everybody realized, hey, they did have a meaningful statement to make.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually worthwhile, and of course they became heroes later.
Right,
which
yeah.
They probably didn't expect to become, but So I think that was a definite positive. I think 68, the other thing you didn't mention, and what, the emergence of the long-distance African runners.
Yeah.
That was. I mean, they've won everything since then.
Yeah.
That was the first time that they did anything internationally that I remember, and they've of course dominated since then.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in the track world. That was a big event.
Yeah. And then the second part of that was, I guess, how did 68 compare with the other games you took part in?
68 was, for two reasons, I think it was special for me. It was the fact that it was the first one, and the fact that I was there for such a long time. I really felt like I was part of it more. You know, I was there almost 4 weeks before the Olympics started, and got used to the village. And, I mean, it was almost a home there for a while. And that was, I felt very, very comfortable there. So it's a special one, probably the most special one. Of course, the Munich one, as you know, had its own events, but we don't need to get into that. And the Munich, for me, the only other thing besides the terrorism was the fact that it was sort of a hometown event. I had a lot of relatives. I still have a lot of relatives in Germany, and they got to see me on TV, and a couple of them in person and so forth. So that was kind of a big deal there. But Mexico still was my first international race and first Olympics, and you know, everything was amazing. I was more in awe.
Yeah.
Probably wasn't the best for my competing, but it was the best as far as my thinking back on it, just as an event in life.
Great. I guess, do you have any thoughts, just thinking about this whole project of getting interviews and getting the oral histories of the 68 team? Do you have any thoughts on this project? Anything you'd like to say about it?
I think Tom's doing a great job. I mean, he's amazing on organizer, and I mean, he's helped bring the 68 team together again.
Mm-hmm.
But more than that, I mean, he had a reunion for the 08 send-off team, and it turned into a much bigger event than just the 68 team, and he's a great catalyst. And I think, you know, this probably wouldn't have happened without him, but I think it's good. I think it's that there's a lot of historical events that did take place, as you mentioned, and you're going to obviously get a lot of overlap from, and maybe a little differences of opinion,
yeah,
of what took place down there. I mean, it was over 40 years ago. Some of my memories aren't as good as others. But I think it's really nice. I'd love to see the final results.
Yeah, I mean, we're building it up, you know, piece by piece. So the big, you know, the real major project is just getting it all sort of archived and transcribed and going through that whole process, but we're making good progress, I think.
Yeah. It's nice to kind of reconnect with some of the folks. You know, all that helps. And this is part of it, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sort of out of questions here, I think. So is there anything, you know, final comments?
You know, I kind of interjected things that I had made notes on as we talked, so I don't really have anything else to add unless...
Okay. That's fine. Like I said, you know, once this is transcribed, which may be several months from now, you'll get a copy and have a chance to make, you know, any additional comments that you might have left out or anything like that. Do you have any other questions for me right now?
No, not at this point.
Okay, well...
Feel free to send me an email or something if you have any, you know, questions that were left out or whatever. I mean, you have my email, obviously.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, same goes for you. If you think of anything later on that you aren't okay. sure about, by all means.
Okay. I guess this, and logistically wise, how many folks are working on this?
Well, we have Desiree, who was the one who contacted you initially, and she sort of heads up things. And then we have maybe six or seven other interviewers mm-hmm. that are, you know, constantly sort of going down the list and contacting people. So,
mm-hmm. how many people have you? What percentage do you think you're going to get out of the Olympic team?
You know, I don't know if I could really give you an accurate estimate, because I think they're still in the process, Tom is, of still just tracking down people and seeing, you know, if we can actually, you know, find them and if they're willing to do it. So, of the people, that, you know, he has gotten in touch with, I mean, I think most of them have been, agreeable to it, so that's encouraging.
I have a quick aside, just for the hell of it.
Okay.
The people I trained with in Newport, the house we worked out of was, we called it Ralph's Garage because Ralph's was the name of the people that owned the house.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, let's see, three, I guess it was four of us are working out there. I was a canoe paddler, and it was three kayak paddlers.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, out of the men's events, there was a single kayak, single canoe, double kayak, double canoe.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up winning all the races out of Ralph's Garage. So that was kind of a big cheering section there for the four of us.
Yeah, the beginnings of your own club right there.
Yeah, exactly. So the only person that wasn't in that was the guy I paddled with in the two-man canoe. We kind of jumped together at the last minute and ended up winning, and he hadn't been training there. But all the other, you know, the single kayak and the double kayak and me, we'd all been training there, so we had a pretty good clean sweep.
Good.
We must have been doing something right.
Yeah, definitely.
A little fun aside there.
No, we love asides. Those are the best parts. So. Well, thank you very much for your time. I really
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It. And like I said, if you have anything else, don't hesitate to contact me.
Well, good luck with your project, and thanks for your efforts and so forth. It'll be interesting to see the results.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Take care.
Yeah,
bye.
Bye now.
Good guy.
Yeah.